From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in Loveland, Colorado in 2005. More than 1,000 people had paid to hear Donald Trump's advice about how to be successful. The episode is described in the new book, The Making of Donald Trump, by investigative journalist David K. Johnston. The crowd that day might have expected a carefully prepared or even rehearsed presentation. Perhaps Trump would tell personal stories of how he executed deals, pulled business deals out of the fire. No. Instead, Johnston writes, it quickly became clear there was no real presentation. There were no notes, no outline, no real plan. It was an hour of a lot of profanity, centered largely on the idea that revenge is what makes a man successful. Get even. He told the audience, quote, be paranoid, because people are going to try to fleece you, end quote. He explained that he loved losers, because losers make Trump feel so good about himself. He even told a story about a woman who once worked for him. He claimed she had been disloyal, because she told Trump she couldn't help him when a particular request seemed unethical to her. He had responded by firing her, then rooting for her own personal downfall. This is just one vignette in a new book that offers a broad portrait of the presidential candidate. Johnston has covered Trump for almost 30 years, following Trump's career in casinos and then to other avenues. And this hour, we explore David K. Johnston's reporting on the man who wants to be president. He's in studio. You've been everywhere, it seems. So it's nice to catch you here. How are you?
Exhausted.
I sort of figured you'd be exhausted, yeah. And this is the reason I started on this vignette here, David. You have an entire section of your book on how Donald Trump is obsessed with revenge. He's given entire speeches, as I mentioned. In his books, he's devoted chapters to revenge. Not only getting back at someone who's done something to you, he says do it tenfold, do it many more times over. He tried to financially ruin an author, Tim O'Brien, who you know well, who claimed that Trump is not worth nearly as much money as he claims. And Trump has admitted he knew he couldn't even win that suit. He just wanted to try to cost the author a fortune in legal fees. So I want to know, are you being sued right now?
No. Donald did call me on April 27th at my home and tell me that, I like a lot of things you've written, Dave, but if I don't like what you write, I'm going to sue you. And I said, Donald, you're a public figure. And what that means under the law is he would have to show that I knowingly, maliciously wrote falsehoods. I knew they were false and I wrote them anyway. And Donald says, I know I'm a public figure, but I'll sue you anyway. Now, you know, from the very first political campaign I wrote about in Santa Cruz County, California, 1966 to that day, no politician, candidate for president, senator, governor, judge, has ever said, you better write what I want or I'll sue you. And I don't think people understand how Trump has very successfully intimidated the news media. I was writing a piece at the time for Politico magazine, documenting Donald's many, many connections to con artists, swindlers, a major drug trafficker he went to bat for, Russian mobsters, traditional mafia mobsters. Not one thing in the story was new. It was all from things that had been published in the past. I just pulled together, and it was the most heavily lawyered piece of my career. I've exposed spies, foreign agents, accused people of murder, and nothing like the lawyering on this piece, which tells me how much Trump has threatened and intimidated the managements of news organizations.
No question. In fact, in this campaign, he has said he wants to loosen libel law to make it easier to sue and to essentially shut down journalists when he doesn't like their
stories. Well, and he says, we're going to get rich suing these journalists. And he's also said that journalists shouldn't be able to write what he thinks is untrue. That's an astonishingly anti-American position. If he thinks it's not true, you shouldn't be able to publish it. Because Donald, in many ways, thinks that he is superior to all the rest of us. And by the way, Evan, if you don't buy that, Donald has a word for you. Loser.
Yes. Well, but David, a serious question, because we had a panel discussion looking at libel law and the fact that—
Yes, I listened to it.
Unlikely that a President Trump could walk in and wave a wand and say, well, now libel law changes. It doesn't quite work that way. My concern is he would think it doesn't matter. He would try to create an executive order. He would, because he has created his own reality in many ways, as your book details. Are you concerned as a journalist that he would at least try?
Oh, if Donald becomes President of the United States, I have absolutely zero doubt that I will have some sort of problems with the federal government, whether it's tax audits, even though my wife and I are extremely careful about that because I read about taxes and she's a fiduciary of a public charity.
You're writing a whole new tax code, aren't you?
Yeah, my next book, the one I put aside for this, is I'm literally drafting the statutory language and the narrative for why we need a whole new tax system.
Okay.
But Donald will do that. He will find people in the government who will go after people. I mean, Nixon's enemies list will be turned into a little asterisk in history compared to what I'm sure Donald would do. And I have spoken to some fairly senior former military officers I know who tell me that they're confident the people who sit in the Situation Room are brushing up on how you refuse an unlawful order, since Trump has talked about things like using nuclear weapons in Europe, where we have allies. He doesn't know what the nuclear triad was. He had to be schooled on it by Hugh Hewitt.
And by, as you've said, by Marco Rubio.
I mean, Marco Rubio, who schooled him on it, was Hugh Hewitt who asked the questions.
Exactly right, yeah.
The right-wing radio talk show host. Very smart guy, Hugh Hewitt. And Donald has made it clear that he has no regard for the law. I mean, Donald doesn't know what the Constitution sets as the limits, duties, and responsibilities of the president. Listen to what he says. He's going to tell corporations like Ford and Nabisco where they can invest and build a plant. He's going to build a wall with Mexico. He's going to refuse entry to the country to Muslims, including serving officers of the United States military. Now, the president doesn't have the power to do any of those things. He's also picked a fight with Speaker Ryan and now named as his campaign CEO, someone who wants Ryan out as Speaker. No legislation moves in Congress unless the Speaker moves it. No politician, even the most novice politician, would pick a fight with the Speaker if they want legislation moved. But of course, if you're Donald and you think you just order it and it gets done, then what do you care about the Speaker? He's just an obstacle to your plans.
Well, and when it comes to the question on revenge, David tells a story in his book. There's a lot of stories in his book, The Making of Donald Trump, which is out now, that I did not know about Trump and his background and the history. But there was one in particular that stands out, and that was when it came to revenge with a family member with a sickly child.
Yeah.
Can you briefly tell that story?
Sure. Donald put the life of his grandnephew in jeopardy. Right after his father died, about a couple days later, this grandnephew was born in the line of his late older brother, Fred Trump Jr. The child was immediately very sickly, stopped breathing twice, ran up $300,000 in medical bills very quickly. Now, Donald Trump believes in universal health care. He said that many times. He's told me that when we've talked. And the Trump organization, like many family businesses, supplies all family members with health care. Well, shortly after this, the will of Fred Trump was read, and it turned out that instead of splitting the money up five ways, it was cut up four ways. The line of the late Fred Trump Jr. was basically cut out of the will. They got a little tiny piece of money. I know you'll be shocked to hear that they went to court and said undue influence, particularly because Fred Trump died of Alzheimer's. Donald immediately cut off health care. He was asked, well, you're putting the life of this child in jeopardy. The family says so, the doctors say so, and he goes, I don't like people who sue my father's estate. Donald, don't you think that's cold-hearted? What else can I do? Donald Trump does not regard other people as people. It's one of the most important things to understand. It's a man who publicly humiliated the mother of his then small children when he divorced her, Ivana Trump, went out of his way to humiliate her in public and make private matters page one news in the New York tabloids. And in contrast to this, by the way, Donald sought mercy for a major cocaine trafficker named Joey Wechselbaum, a convicted felon and mob front, from whom Donald obtained his helicopters, including his personal helicopter back then called the Ivana. There are lots of helicopter companies Donald Trump could have gone to, but he went to this guy. And when this guy gets indicted as a big drug trafficker running drugs from Miami to Cincinnati, Ohio, he agrees to plead guilty. He asks that his case be moved to either Miami or New York City where he lives. And instead, it gets moved to North New Jersey. Now, neither the prosecution or the defense can explain how this happened, and it ends up before Judge Marianne Trump Berry, Donald's sister. She removed herself from the case, but, you know, look at the conversation about that. She has to go to the chief judge and say, I'm sorry, I can't handle this man's case because my husband, who's a lawyer for Donald, flies in his helicopters every week, and I fly in him. You have a federal judge flying around in a drug trafficker's helicopters. By the way, Donald wrote a letter begging for mercy for this man. Tried to cover it up. didn't succeed in covering it up. He got 18 months as the leader of the drug trafficking operation. The people who just drove the drugs up to Cincinnati, they got up to 20 years. Donald's never explained why he did this, and as a casino owner, he could have lost his license for this. You are not to associate with criminals if you own a casino. What would prompt a man to risk his incredibly lucrative casino license on behalf of a major drug trafficker? That's a question that nobody has asked Donald. I raise the question of what would prompt him to do this in the book. I don't know the answer, but what we do know is this. Donald needed this drug trafficker to be his friend and not his enemy, and it shouldn't surprise us, therefore, that after he got out of the clink, Joey Wechselbaum moved into Trump Tower.
David K. Johnston is my guest for the hour, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist whose new book is called The Making of Donald Trump. It's out now. You have any questions about what David K. has covered when it comes to Trump, this book, some of the particulars, you can call the program. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Somebody will call and ask what David thinks Trump is actually worth. We'll get to that later, because there's probably very few people in this country who can understand tax law, avoidance, taking advantage of the system the way David has been working on in his many books over the years. So I'm sure that'll come up. But if anything you want to call and talk about in regards to Trump and David K. Johnston's investigative work, you can do that this hour. And again, if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You just mentioned, though, I'm going to kind of jump ahead in my own notes, but you just mentioned some of these unsavory ties.
Yes, there are lots of them.
There are lots of them. And in a second, I'd like you to tell us a little bit more about one of the men in particular who, you know, kind of helped start these ties very early on, connected to the mob, Mr. Cohn. But before we do that, you know, there are people who heard what you just said, and they think, well, big deal. As Bill Nojay said to the Democrat and Chronicle, state assemblyman who's been defending Donald Trump and supporting him, he says, he told the Chronicle, quote, to say that a real estate developer would have contact with criminal mobsters in the 1980s is like saying you get dirt on your feet if you go to a farm.
Well,
end quote. In other words, big deal, everybody. You couldn't do business in the casino industry,
right,
or real estate without bumping into mobsters.
There's a big difference between bumping into mobsters and doing what Donald Trump did. And if Bill Nojay would do some research, he would know better. Well, other big developers in New York, notably the Lefrak and Resnick families, went to the FBI and Rudy Giuliani and said, please rid us of these mobsters. Donald Trump embraced them. He ran to them. And it got him a lot of benefits. When he tore down Bonwit Teller, the 12-story department store, to build Trump Tower, he was able to get about 150 to 200 illegal immigrants, men from Poland known as the Polish Brigade, to work alongside union members of the House Wreckers Union, because Roy Cohn's clients, the mobsters Fat Tony Salerno and Paul Castellano, controlled the necessary unions. Well, the least expensive and best way at the time to build a high-rise building would be steel girder construction. That would mean dealing with honest unions like the steel workers. But by using ready-mix concrete, Donald had unions that were under the thumb of these mobsters, and he bought his concrete from S&A Concrete, owned by Fat Tony Salerno and Paul Castellano. In Atlantic City, Donald engaged in a series of land transactions, including a very curious one I detail in the book, with two young mobsters known as the Young Executioners. The Scarfo family was far more vicious than any other mob family in America, so much so it finally destroyed the family. And Donald paid exorbitantly excessive prices for a little piece of land that they owned. He made other deals with other mob fronts for Nicodemo Scarfo, Nicky Scarfo, some of which make no economic sense. And in all of these matters, Donald does this just as he deals with con artists and swindlers and others, because it's a source of money. Anybody who comes to Donald Trump and says, I'm going to put a bunch of money in your pocket so long, and you don't have to put up a penny. No investment by you or anything else. We're going to put money in your pocket. Donald, he's all ears to those deals, and he makes no effort to vet people and check them out. So violent felon, doesn't matter. Drug dealer, doesn't matter. Show me the money.
So before we get to your calls, and the phones have lit up for David K. Johnston, just to follow on the question of Mr. Cohn, because
yeah.
Trump, early in his real estate career, his father was building an empire. He was still alive. This is around 1970, if I'm remembering the dates and times correctly. You know, Donald Trump has this habit of telling people he never settles. You know, which is ridiculous, of course, because it's a lie. But he says he never settles, and one of the reasons is once you start settling, you get branded as a loser. You're a pushover. You know, you got to fight it. You got to hit back. So not only does he like to say he doesn't settle, but he likes to countersue. In the case of what happened in, was it 1970, David?
1973.
Tell me the lesson of this case, because this is not something. I know Nicholas Kristof wrote briefly about this in the Times in a column. We haven't seen much of it written in this campaign.
Right. You haven't seen most of what people should know about Donald Trump. He has not been well vetted. And, you know, I've been very critical of my fellow journalists. And I've written press criticism for 40 years. I'm the only journalist who caused a broadcast chain to be forced off the air for news manipulations and blackouts. Donald Trump's father discriminated against blacks, Puerto Ricans, and others. In the book, I have a Woody Guthrie song. Woody Guthrie lived for a while in a Trump project, and he wrote about it. In 1968, after Martin Luther King's assassination, Congress passed the Fair Housing Law. In 72, testers were sent. So a black or Puerto Rican individual or couple with sound finances would be sent to seek an apartment at a Trump building. If they were rejected, as all of them were, then a white couple or individual with the same exact finances would then go, and they'd be, oh, we have wonderful apartments. Let us show you those various apartments. Roy Cohn told Donald Trump to go on the attack against the government over this. And Donald Trump and Roy Cohn held a press conference in which they said that the federal government was trying to force them to take people on welfare. Complete lie. Had nothing to do with welfare. Then a freshly minted lawyer on what I think was her very first case, it was very close to it if it wasn't her first case, she had just passed the bar, is assigned to the case against the great Roy Cohn. And they end up settling. Because they've got the facts, and Roy just has bluster, and Donald just has bluster. So for 2 years, Trump apartments are rented under supervision. There is no racial discrimination. The supervision ends, and right after that, the government sends out testers, and guess what? They were right back to coding names to steer Latinos and blacks away from projects, and except for the ones where they wanted them to be.
And I think David K. Johnston in the book makes an important point that when we understand the language used by people after settlements, Donald Trump liked to say, we settled, but they never proved that we did anything wrong. There are nuanced ways of describing it that if you don't know how the game is played, you may think, oh, well, he's right. But
well, the federal government routinely makes settlements with people in which you promise in which you never admit that you did what you promised to never do again. And Donald settles all the time, and he's often paid money to seal the record. And I cite records of things in one case where a woman in his building who somehow with no visible means of support except her incredibly gorgeous looks was able to buy the three apartments directly underneath Donald's, got a mortgage without an application because Donald called a banker. Wonder what was going on with this case. She was the boyfriend of a corrupt union leader. And when she and Donald got into a dispute after her boyfriend went to prison, Donald sued her, and she then filed in the court a statement saying, well, I have all these records I can put in the court record, which would provide the basis for a criminal investigation of Mr. Trump. He immediately settled, paid her money, and that was the end of it. And that's not the only time this has happened.
To some of our listeners' calls we go, and first off air, just as a clarification, where is the book available, David?
Everywhere. We sold it all around the world, and a German language edition comes out in Europe next week.
And have you done more interviews on foreign shows than domestic shows?
I have been on national news shows in Australia, multiple ones, Australia, Canada, England, France, Germany. The big three U.S. networks, not a word. And when I was on PBS, they taped it, and every reference to Donald and criminals, misconduct, all cut out. Every single word.
Why do you think this is, David?
Well, in case of PBS, I think, and NPR, I think that Congress has threatened to cut off the funding. And that's why you see this very genteel coverage. In the case of the networks, I'm stunned. I mean, they're big enough that the lawsuit threats shouldn't bother them. But I keep seeing people on who don't know what they're talking about. I mean, subjects I know about, I'm watching them on Sunday morning, and they have no idea what they're talking about. They're coming up with crazy theories, Michael Moore's nutty theories about Donald Trump. And they're not having me on. And it's not that the publicist who's fantastic on this book hasn't tried really hard, that friends of mine at the networks, correspondents that I know at the networks, peers of mine, have tried. And nobody's gotten anywhere.
When it comes to your politics, another listener off air just wanted to know, can David say what his political stance is?
I'm a registered Republican. I have been for many years. Before that, I was in Tom Golisano's party. But, you know, I'm not a partisan person. I'm a policy person. I don't normally write about political campaigns. I write about policies. I write about the economy. But in this case, I know Donald Trump. I don't know Hillary Clinton. So I haven't written a book about her.
But you have said you are disappointed in her lack of media access, haven't you?
Oh, I'm highly critical of her, as I've been of President Obama, that they are not being transparent and open and readily available. But, you know, when I left the Los Angeles Times in 1988, I didn't go to Little Rock, Arkansas. I went to Atlantic City. That's why I'm writing about Trump and not about Clinton. If people read my book and then say, I still want this guy to be president, then vote for him. But at least know that you're voting for a man who has no moral core, who lies the way people breathe, who takes pleasure in destroying the lives of other people, who calls himself a Christian and yet espouses a philosophy that is aggressively anti-Christian.
And that's the philosophy of revenge and hurting people.
Revenge and hurting people. That's exactly right. And who, you know, we now know from the work the New York Times did yesterday, is deeply in debt to banks in China, which all of which are either owned fully or partly by the government. So that means that the nine thugs who run China, the Politburo, they're in Donald Trump's pockets. We know that Russian oligarchs have paid money to Trump, bought properties from Trump, and I've shown that there's a what appears to be a $250 million tax fraud that Trump is currently only a material witness in, that he had to approve the actions that led to this tax fraud. That leads back to Russian oligarchs. And a few days ago, there was a terrific investigative piece in the New York Times about Vladimir Putin murdering people. We've known he's done this for years. And I discovered to my amazement that Duma passed a law that allows him to murder people as long as they're outside of Russia. So here we have a president who was a presidential candidate putting forth the major foreign policy objective of the leader in Russia, which is to destroy or weaken NATO, and who has financial entanglements with the oligarchs in Russia. And you're either with Putin in Russia as an oligarch or you're in jail or dead. And who has huge borrowings, hundreds of millions of dollars of borrowings that put him in hock to the Chinese government, which he keeps attacking. This is just beyond, if you'd written this as a novel, even 15 years ago, nobody would have believed it. I mean, I could just, you know, see editors at houses writing back saying this story is beyond belief. No one would accept the reality of this. It's here.
Well, let's see what I think a Trump supporter in our first call. It's John in Rochester. John, are you a Trump supporter?
Yeah. I'm going to vote for Trump. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
But I was more of a Rubio and a Rubio fan, and also Ted.
Ted Cruz.
Right.
Sure.
Right. But you know, David, did you read Trump's book, Art of a Deal?
I've read every one of his books.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, I was a big Trump fan back in the 80s. And
I mean, he didn't write that book. You know that, right, John? And the guy who did write the book is now disavowing it, saying it was the biggest mistake of his career.
But anyway, I didn't know that. But,
yes,
but anyways,
yes,
I was a little disappointed in the book because he came across as being greedy in the book, and it kind of disillusioned me a little bit about him. But I got to say, I think he's the best choice. But Evan, a question for you.
Yes.
David sounds like Roger Stone of the left in this book. I read Roger Stone's book on Clinton's war on women, and I haven't read Clinton Cash yet or Crisis of Character. David, have you read Roger Stone's book? Your book sounds almost identical.
John, it's not even in the same ballpark. Roger Stone is a disreputable, lying, malicious, vicious person.
What about Clinton Cash by Peter Schweitzer?
Can I finish? Can I finish?
Well, you sound pretty vindictive right now.
John, hold on. Be polite. Let David finish. We can have a conversation here. We're going to keep you on the line. Go ahead, David.
I've been an investigative reporter for almost 50 years. I have exposed foreign agents. I have saved taxpayers hundreds of billions of dollars. I've written stories that sent many people to prison. I personally hunted down a vicious murderer and won freedom for an innocent man. My record is unblemished. Everything I've written, stories that people couldn't believe. When I reported that the police chief in L.A. was assigning officers to sleep with women to get information, nobody believed it. Well, subsequent events proved that I was exactly on the money. And everything I've written has held up. Roger Stone is a political operative. He is a hired gun. I'm not. Now, I have not read Peter Schweitzer's book. Peter Schweitzer is a reasonably competent journalist. I mean, frankly, he's not in my league, but he's reasonably competent. I haven't read his book. And as I said earlier, the reason I haven't written about Hillary Clinton is I don't know her. I've never met her. I've never talked to her. I wrote two stories about her in my life. She tried to get me fired over those two stories in the New York Times, which made her look foolish. I showed how she paid more than twice as much federal income tax as the law required. What I do know is Donald Trump, and I have told you there are 44 pages of documentation in the back of my book. You can check everything I've written to see what's in the public
record. Roger Stone has a lot of documentation, too, and a lot of verifiable information in that book. I haven't read Clinton Cash yet.
But
my question to you, Evan, is are you going to have Roger Stone on or Peter Schweitzer
no,
or whatever?
Because I have no interest in Roger Stone. Well, I mean, look, I don't say no interest.
But I'll tell you.
I'll have Hugh Hewitt on. Hugh Hewitt can come on this program. He wrote
real
The Queen.
I've got to tell you.
Oh, I'm sorry. You think I'm a leftist?
Yeah, I've heard some of your opinions. I'll give you an example. I heard you on WBEN radio a couple of years ago, and you called President Obama one of the most fiscally conservative presidents in modern times.
Because that's what the
debt is. $20 trillion national debt. What do you think of that statement?
$20 trillion came from Barack Obama. The debt went from zero to 20.
John, let me explain it. John, it's true.
He called him the most.
Yes, and let me explain, John. John, are you? I said that.
John's on hold. We can come back to John.
That's not a leftist.
Okay,
John's on hold. We can come back to John. Go ahead.
Let me explain John's point. What John doesn't seem to know.
Okay.
The federal government every year publishes data on the budget deficit. Under President Obama, what's called non-discretionary federal spending has grown at the slowest rate since World War II. George H.W. Bush was the biggest spender. LBJ was behind him, and the smallest has been Obama. There's no question the federal budget deficit has grown enormously under President Obama, just as it did under President George W. Bush. And I'm the guy who told people this was going to happen way back in the year 2000, because the way we change the tax system guarantees that we will continue to spend more than we bring in. That's why I'm drafting an entirely new federal tax code that gets rid of the corporate income tax, that allows you to move your investments around during your lifetime with no taxes, so long as you keep the money in your account, and has other reforms for the economy. And, you know, I'm the founder of a business. And saying that President Obama has been the most fiscally conservative president is a factual statement. It has nothing to do with politics. I'll be glad to send John, if he wants to email me at davidcay@me.com, the federal government annual reports that will show how spending under President Obama has grown the least of any president in modern times, discretionary spending.
And before I go back to John, let's see if evidence changes anything. You know, he was accusing the people in this room of being leftists for entertaining these questions on the actual factual record of Donald Trump here. John, you know, people can form whatever opinions they want about me as a host and about how I conduct interviews. I'm not all that interested in Roger Stone on this program for the reasons that David Kay brings up. But I would have Hugh Hewitt in a heartbeat. In fact, Hugh and I are both Cleveland natives and fans, and we joke around on Twitter about our beloved Cleveland teams. I respect Hugh Hewitt. I know a lot of Hillary Clinton voters don't like him, but Hugh is a righty, but he's a very smart guy.
He's a very smart guy, and he's asked, along with Megyn Kelly, the three people who've asked good questions in this campaign are all on TV. They're Hugh Hewitt first, Megyn Kelly second, and Katie Tour at MSNBC. And the rest of them, I'm just sadly disappointed. But, you know, I deal in verifiable facts, and everything I've done for 50 years has stood up to scrutiny. And I've had competitors go after it. I've had presidents of the U.S. go after it. Congress did the biggest investigation in the history of the Ways and Means Committee over my work. I'm sorry, the Joint Tax Committee over my work. And they produced an 1,800-page report that completely verified what I had reported, that the New York Times got all sorts of letters saying, oh, this is ridiculous, can't be true. 1,800-page report, totally verified what I wrote.
Well, and let me just say before I come back to John, I will also add this. My political leanings don't really matter. I try to be someone who brings in multiple voices. You're going to see that next hour. We have libertarians, Greens, and Working Families Party people coming in. And we're all going to sing Kumbaya and have a great time talking about busting up the duopoly. But... John, go back a couple of weeks on this program. We talked about Hillary Clinton's college plan. What do the facts say? It is unserious, unfunded, with potential unintended consequences. That's just what we know about the policy right now. That's not my, you know, that's not a hack political opinion. That is what the evidence says right now. That's what we talked about on this program. David Kaye and I mentioned she has been dodging the press when it comes to news conferences. I find that a big problem no matter what the party is. So this notion that this is a conspiracy of the
Evan, one of the things John might want to know, the first national journalist to write a very searing criticism of Barack Obama's president was me, and it was 9 days after he took office, and I got lots of criticism from people who said it was too early, and what I wrote, namely that he would not be the most transparent administration
ever.
As he had promised, would not turn out to be true, and we now know that that's exactly the case. He manages the message much more tightly than George Bush, who did it more tightly than Clinton, and my experience in White Houses goes all the way back to Nixon. So, you know, I'm the first guy who wrote the tough piece about Obama, and I'm a leftist. That just doesn't compute.
All right, John, any follow-up? Go ahead.
Okay, I saw the market study done on the Fast Ferry, and guess what that study said, that the Fast Ferry would be profitable within a year. So what's your statistics say? The fact is...
No, here's where you're missing something. That was a made-as-instructed study paid for by the people behind it.
Some of your stuff is made-as-instructed.
No, it's not. Who instructs me? The data that I'm telling you about is the official annual reports that are used by Congress and the President to determine federal spending.
David, when you say that the national debt's at $20 trillion, it's almost doubled since Obama's been in office.
Yes, it has.
And you can say with a straight face he's one of the fiscally conservative presidents.
I didn't say that.
Our
GDP increase is
at the slowest rate since the...
John, you're not listening to what I said. You're making up stuff. Yes,
what
you
the,
are. I never said he was fiscally conservative.
I
never said the terms fiscally conservative. What I said and what the data shows, and as I gave you my email address, I'll be glad to send you the official reports that Democrats and Republicans alike rely on, is that we've had the slowest increase in discretionary federal spending under President Obama. We had the greatest growth rate under Bush and the second greatest under LBJ, and I'm talking about here since the end of World War II.
In other words, he has been the most fiscally conservative president in recent presidencies. It doesn't mean that he is a fiscal conservative.
That's exactly right. Those are different things.
Sure. But, John, I don't want to get sidetracked. There's a couple of people who wrote in just saying, you know, hey, are you going to spend an hour on Hillary Clinton's misdeeds? I got an email from someone saying, what about all the dead people in the Clinton orbit? I mean, there is some very strange conspiracy stuff. There is not evidence. I'm going to make this very, very clear, just because I meet a lot of people who don't like Hillary Clinton, who are very smart people, who think that she's actually having people knocked off on almost a daily basis. There's
several,
no evidence of that.
I've had several leading members of this community tell me that they can't vote for Hillary because she has hitmen going around killing people. And that's just the most bizarre, incredible stuff. Hillary Clinton tried to get me fired. Why would they think anything nice of Hillary Clinton?
Yeah, and listeners who want to know about other misdeeds, aside from the alleged murders, there are absolutely valid questions about pay to play. There are questions that are being explored right now about the Clinton Foundation, connections there. And as those continue to surface, which they should and need to before the election, you'll hear more of a conversation on this program, not only about that, but about what it means to good government groups who get so frustrated with this notion of the impact of money and pay to play. And is that a valid question? Yes, and will you hear it on this program? You certainly will. Let's get our only break of the hour. We'll come back with more of your calls for David Kaye Johnston. He's an investigative journalist whose new book is The Making of Donald Trump. Your call's next. Coming up in our second hour, the success of third parties. There's a lot of attention on the presidential debates. Will Gary Johnson, will Jill Stein have a chance to participate? But what about local elections? Should third parties be focusing their energy and resources on winning locally, then building organizations that way before aiming nationally? We'll tackle that question, your perspective as well, next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. The phone's lighting up again, and on Twitter, Kate writes to us and says, Evan and David, based on 08 predictions of Obama and transparency, would a Hillary presidency be worse? Kate, I would just say it's impossible to know. I'm just not sanguine about Hillary Clinton and when it comes to transparency. It has been almost a year since a full news conference, so yeah. I don't know how David feels about that. I am not optimistic about transparency in a Clinton administration.
I agree with you. I don't think that she's going to be transparent. I think she's going to be very controlling in the message. And it's very unfortunate that she has reacted to all these attacks on her over the years by developing this really calloused approach to things. Very unfortunate for the country.
All right, back to the phones. Rachel in Rochester. Next up, go ahead, Rachel.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Right off the bat, I'm not in love with Hillary Clinton, but I am frightened to death of the sociopath that's running for the GOP. And as Mr. Kay has had a lot of time to research him, along with the gentleman who wrote The Art of the Deal, and they have both come forward with really, you know, unrefutable facts about what a terrible person this guy is. How do we go about explaining to people like John that, despite what you think, there's a lot of misinformation out there that's covering up, and it's like, oh, he's a good guy. He says what he thinks. But I want to know how to change minds.
Rachel, I don't know how you change minds. I know that what I've done is reported all my career facts that people often found, you know, unbelievable at the time, like the police chief in L.A. had officers undercover in Moscow and Havana and was having officers sleep with women to get information that people were like, what? But I know that if people are presented with facts, at least you've done the part the founders wanted. They wanted us to run this country based on rational discourse and reason, not on prejudice, not on assumptions. And, you know, so I do my little part here in everything I'm doing. And by the way, shortly you're going to see a victory I've won for taxpayers where there's an industry in America exempt from the corporate income tax that forces you by regulation to pay the tax. And it looks like that's going to stop after my years of work exposing it.
But Rachel's point, I think, or at least her question, is an important one.
Yeah.
If people are generally impervious to facts, no matter where they stand, what have we wrought? I mean, that is troublesome.
Well, yes. And look, there's been a very well-funded 40-year campaign to attack honest journalism. And it has had an impact. It has absolutely had an impact. And I've seen it throughout my career. And I don't know. I know that, you know, one of the ways that the Soviets kept people in line was by making sure that nobody knew what to believe. And I think we have to have a society in which people recognize some people are trustworthy and they tell you things you can believe, and you need to learn to distinguish them from people. Roger Stone is a good example, who make things up and manipulate and deceive you, from people whose track record establishes without question, like mine, that you get solid facts, reliable, rounded, solid facts. So.
There's a couple of points that you make in the book regarding this notion of the fable that's been woven versus the reality. And let's hit a couple of them very quickly before I jump back to the phones. Number one, Trump loves to say how intelligent he is, how extremely intelligent he is, how extremely, extremely intelligent he is. He's gone to the best schools. He's the most studied. He's got lots of words. But you have found that there are certain basic economic and financial industry terms he doesn't even know.
Right. My students at Syracuse University, who are law and graduate business students, could answer a particular question with the snap of the finger after they finish my course. Donald says that he went to the super genius Wharton School. He didn't. He went to the undergraduate school. But even so, he was unable under oath to answer a very basic, simple question that anyone in business should know how to do. And his answer is gibberish. And there are other occasions that show this. And it's a saying I use based on my years of knowing Donald, covering Donald, having lunch with Donald, gave advice to Donald once on his taxes. He doesn't know anything. He didn't know what the nuclear triad was.
And if I could jump in, you pointed out in the book, not only did he get it wrong, I think, in Hugh Hewitt's radio show, 4 months later in the CNN debate with Hugh Hewitt on the panel, Hugh Hewitt asked the same question, which is fine. He had showed no progress in terms of understanding.
That's right. And when by chance I ran into Hugh Hewitt Sunday a week ago, he said to me that was just astonishing to him that Trump had 4 months to learn this, and he didn't. And my column tomorrow that will run tomorrow at the Daily Beast and Investopedia is about, you know, Donald has no plan. Every successful executive and business owner I know, and I'm a business founder, co-founder, operates from a plan. Donald just doesn't have anything by the seat of his pants.
Okay. And then the other point on this sort of myth versus reality is this notion of deal making. I've talked to many people who say, look, you don't have to like everything about him, but we need a hard driving deal maker. And you have pointed out that he tended to go into a lot of negotiations, at least from my view of reading your book, either unprepared or sort of overreaching, thinking he was going to get, I look at Mar-a-Lago, I look at a lot of different things where the notion of hard-driving, brilliant dealmaker is not necessarily
deserved. I show in the book from Donald's own words that he deceives his own partners, that he lies to his own partners, that he has boasted that he borrowed money knowing he wouldn't pay it back. That's frankly, that's immoral. I don't know what else to call that. Donald has had to go to the Chinese communists and the Russian oligarchs to borrow money because American banks don't want anything to do with him anymore. And there's an article coming out shortly by a couple of law professors who teach negotiation as a legal skill, critiquing Donald, and it's pretty hard on him in his negotiating skills. I've had to negotiate with Donald many times over issues of how something is going to be cast or whatever, and he's not very good at it.
There's a lot of threats.
A lot of bullying and a lot of threats.
One of the consistent aspects coming up is threats of lawsuit, threats of trying to intimidate or shake people down.
That's right.
Back to the phones we go, and this is Paul in Irondequoit. Go ahead, Paul.
I'm an independent voter, and I've listened to everything that's wrong with Trump, and I replace the word Trump and just stick any other one in there, and you get the same result. Is what the author's saying now. But I'm going with Golisano, and he's for Trump, and right now I'm for Trump. But I can change my mind in a heartbeat. But my real question is, you say that the press is being attacked over the last 40 years regarding their constitutional rights. Well, I don't see any constitutional rights that aren't being attacked continually.
Stay on the line, Paul, because I think there's a couple of points that I want to explore with David and you. So stay on the line, Paul. Go ahead, David.
Well, first of all, I'm not talking about constitutional rights. That's not the issue here. The issue is the creation of this idea. You see it on bumper stickers. You can't trust the liberal media. I sat down on a plane one day in New York going to California, and got upgraded to first class. And I had a New York Times I put down between the seats. And the guy next to me, who's in a very nice suit, says, you know, you read that? And I go, well, I bought it inside the airport. He says, you know, there's no facts in it. It's just all opinion. They just make it all up. And I said, really? And I cajoled this guy into going through the paper, because on the front page was a story I was going to use for a lecture I was giving in Los Angeles as how to take a very complex, politically charged issue and report about it in a neutral, rounded way. And he kept going through the paper. And finally, he goes, look at this. This is just opinion. It was Paul Krugman's column on the op-ed page, and it turned out this guy, who's an MBA at one of the big banks, did not know the difference between news and opinion pages. I mean, I was just gobsmacked by this. And that's the attack. It's not on there's certainly various problems the press is having. Governments are trying very hard to shut down access to information. I've written a lot about this, about the phony excuses governments come up with for withholding public records.
No doubt.
But there's this, a well-funded campaign. You have people like Brent Bozell, his father, who was literally a Falangist fascist, who constantly claim things are untrue. Well, I've gone and run down many of these stories, and it turns out that, no, it's the attack it's untrue. And journalists deal in verifiable facts. You know, in my book, you can go check. There's a bunch of notes in the back about it. And by the way, I don't think that Trump is the same as other candidates. I make that very clear. He is not. We have never had in modern times a candidate anything like Trump, someone who does business deals for profit with mobsters, who puts in life the life of a sickly child in jeopardy over money, who goes to bat for a major cocaine trafficker, deal after deal after deal that I go through, and who under oath can't answer questions. I mean, you can like or dislike Hillary Clinton, but I don't think anybody thinks she doesn't understand how government works and what to do. And interestingly, she is held in high regard by lots of foreign governments as a Secretary of State. I'm not endorsing her. I'm just pointing out that I don't know anybody seriously in business who thinks well of Donald Trump who really knows him. Even Carl Icahn backed up away from him when pressed.
Paul, you want to follow? So Paul, just if you could in sort of briefly articulate, what is it about that Trump that appeals to him? Appeals to you. I'm curious.
Well, I really think that he is more concentrated on the business aspect. Now, right now, I'm swaying towards him, but like I said, I could change.
Sure.
But I really think that the government needs to be run more by a business. And the reason that I say that, and the author there probably understands this, if you've been down to the Washington, D.C. area, it's nothing, well, not nothing, but it is one heck of a establishment of government. And I would like to see the government relocate some of their offices someplace else and spread the wealth. I mean,
that's actually, I think,
government.
Paul, I think that's
it would be nice.
Paul, I think that's a good idea.
Everybody share.
It's an accident of history that the nation's capital is where it is. And I have wondered a lot, and I've given lectures where I've raised the question of what would happen if we moved the capital to Kansas. But I don't want a government run like business, because business is run as a dictatorial regime from the top. I want a government that is accountable and responsible to a democratic people who created it for their benefit, not a business that was created for the benefit of the people who run it and own it.
And Paul, one more quick point here. If you want a Republican who has been a documented success in business in multiple ways, you've got a Republican governor named Gary Johnson running, and he has been a successful businessman in multiple sectors. So he comes without the baggage of Donald Trump and sort of the unverified points. And then the question is Trump as successful as he claims? He almost certainly isn't.
No,
he's not. As high as $11 billion.
In a single day, he has varied statements of his wealth by billions of dollars. And I point out in the book that when asked under oath, well, how do you determine your net worth? You know, most of us add up our assets, subtract our liabilities. Donald says, well, it depends on how I feel.
He actually did.
He literally said that under oath.
No,
at length.
He certainly did, as David's book lays out. Alex writes to us briefly. David, he just says, pretend it's a parlor game. David probably won't answer, but what does he really guess Trump is worth? That's from Alex.
Oh, he's worth something less than $1 billion.
You think he's not a billionaire?
Oh, yeah, no. The most he could possibly be worth is $1 billion. But now that the New York Times report has come out about the $650 million of loans, no. To have Donald's lifestyle requires about $20 to $30 million of after-tax income. And I've shown that Donald cheated on his taxes in 1984. Very strong evidence of tax fraud. He didn't pay income taxes. We know from the public record in 78, 79, these records I found from 84, 92, and 94. And he got the Star property tax credit, which only goes to people who make less than $500,000. And he said, well, it was a mistake, this and that. No, it's done by a computer. The computer looks at the line on your state tax return. If it's under $500,000, you get it. And because he's in real estate, if he owns anywhere near the value of the buildings he says for tax purposes, then he probably hasn't paid income taxes in the last 40 years.
All right, real quick on a couple of points. We've got 90 seconds left. Ron Fournier, former AP chief, says network should not have him on anymore. Starve him of the oxygen he wants until he receives
the
tax returns.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Do you agree with him?
No. We need to have more coverage
and
more attention to these issues.
Okay.
That's completely the same way Donald should get the same classified briefing Hillary Clinton gets. You want more information, not less.
Okay. When it comes to the way the New York Times describes him, Jonathan Martin and others are now writing, quote, the self-described billionaire. And
yes,
the New York Times has said that's not a policy change. They're allowing reporters to describe him that way because they can't verify that claim.
That's exactly right.
Do you think that's a good idea?
I think that's what we should do, is you should say he says he's a billionaire.
Okay. And finally, when it comes to questions, if you were sitting down now with Mr. Trump, if it was connections with David K. Johnston and Donald Trump as your guest, one question or three, where do you start? What do you want to know first from him?
Tell me your plan to get legislation through Congress without the support of Paul Ryan is number one, because nothing moves in Congress without the Speaker, and Donald has picked a fight with him and now made his campaign chairman someone who wants to get rid of him. Secondly, I would ask him, I'll tell you, I have three questions I've written down for Donald. I'm not going to tell you what those are. I will do it after the election. Three for Donald, three for Hillary. They're very simple questions.
Okay.
I'm totally confident Donald could not answer them because, as I said, he doesn't know anything. And I show in the book where when he's put under oath and he can't lie, he doesn't know anything.
David K. Johnston's book is The Making of Donald Trump. It is a book that reads pretty quickly. The chapters are tight, they move, they cover a lot of ground, and they go back to roughly three decades of investigative reporting by the Pulitzer Prize winner. And David K. Johnston, thank you. I know you're on this whirlwind tour, so it's nice to see you in studio. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you. And I just, while we're sitting here, you know, I'm on the New York Times bestseller list and moved up, and I found that I'm number six in San Francisco, and it's selling very well. It's the only Trump book that is on the bestseller list.
Well, I hope we'll come back and talk again soon. I know you will. And maybe you'll tell us what the tax code should be.
Well, that book will be next.
Yeah, that's David K. Johnston. And thanks to all the audience interaction. Let's get a short break. And speaking of politics, third parties, do they have a future? Can we bust up the duopoly on the local level, or should we start nationally? That's next.